popular protest continues to dominate the government proceedings. Biden is very wary that if he comes back to the deal under the current circumstances, the whole world will say that Iran made the U.S. yield and that Iran managed to gain the concessions from the U.S. And this is Biden, much in the same way that Obama did, this is Biden bowing his head towards Iran, just as in 2015 when Obama, in conjunction with the JCPOA, allowed Iran to allow its militias to join the Iraqi army, essentially handing another Iraqi institution to Iranian control. This is the fundamental thing here. It's not about Biden wants to go to the deal, but what prevents Biden from going to the deal is a PR exercise. It's the PR campaign. And it's the same case with Iran. The reason Iran doesn't want to go back to the JCPOA, knowing full well Biden wants to restore the JCPOA, is because Iran cannot viably look its people in the eye. The regime in Iran cannot look its people in the eye and say that U.S. unilaterally withdrew, but we're still going to go back to the JCPOA. In this, Iran has a point, and Iran is justified in this. But what prevents the JCPOA, despite the fact that Biden, Iran, and Europe all want the deal, what prevents it is a PR exercise.
Well, let me What about the sanctions itself? Stay with me, Sami, because you said that the U.S., with Biden, actually wants to return. The deal, which was signed in 2015, they agreed to actually cut out all the sanctions. Actually, all the sanctions were supposed to be dropped. So if, as you say, that Biden and the United States wants to return, why wouldn't they just cancel all the sanctions?
Because then Biden, in front of the world, in front of the allies in the region, in front of Europe, amidst the rising China, amidst the rising Russia, amidst the China that signed the 25-year deal with Iran, that has expanded strategic ties with Turkey, that the UAE has expanded strategic ties with Russia, that Mohammed bin Zayed is on record as saying that the U.S. is no longer a trusted partner, that Saudi Arabia is coming out and saying that the U.S. no longer respects its commitment as a strategic ally, Biden will come out looking like the weak party. The U.S. power and image will be undermined in the region.
Okay.
The U.S. will not be able to recover from that. China and Russia will expand on it. Iran will cement its power, and Biden will lose. And this is why it's a PR exercise. Biden is trying to find a way.
Let me get Mustafa on this. Okay, he says it's PR, and he says because the U.S. will look weak and it won't be trusted. But Mustafa, I want to look at this because it was an agreement that the U.S. signed. So isn't that a worse message to send to the world, that basically years of negotiating this agreement and its sign, and the U.S. never, even under Obama, never abided fully by its commitment? So the question now, also Mustafa, can the U.S. be actually trusted at all, even at this stage again?
Oh, of course not. You know, the goal of the United States is containment strategy. They want to contain Iran's power components in the missile industry, its regional power, its nuclear industry, and they would continue. If they succeed in the JCPOA, then their demands would never end. They would ask for a containment of Iran's nanotechnology. They would ask for a containment of Iran's aerospace technology and many other areas like laser technology. Tehran knows this pretty well. It would not allow the JCPOA, to be expanded to include other areas of its power components. The United States teaches the world at its universities to, you know, be responsible parties in your foreign policy as actors. You need to be responsible. But when it comes into practice, what we see is rule of the jungle, law of the jungle by the U.S. officials. If 7, 6, 8, 10 years ago, people had doubt about this very fact, that the U.S. is not a responsible party, now everyone knows this pretty well throughout the world. It's been a scandal, especially after Donald Trump came to power. We have too many confessions from Biden to Jake Sullivan, to Hillary Clinton, to Michael Flynn, to General Dempsey, the chairman of the United States Joint Chiefs of Staff, and many others, that it was the United States allies, Saudi Arabia and others, with the knowledge of the United States, that started this war of terrorism in this region, that supported Daesh, trained them, and went for toppling Assad and Iraq's Shiite government, and they failed, you know. I do agree that the United States is way weaker than 6 years ago. Now, it's just facing rising powers in this region.
Okay, stay with
Iran,
me, Mustafa. Let me give 30 seconds to Sami. Stay with
rise
me.
Of China.
Stay with me, please. 30 seconds, Sami, because I'm just about out of time. Sami, where do you think this is going? So the JCPOA parties are meeting in Vienna on Tuesday. Do you think that anything concrete can come out of or from this meeting?
I think there's reason to be optimistic. I think if you monitor what's happening in Yemen, what's happening in Iraq and these other places, when you see that Iran is still engaging with calls from the EU to stick to the deal, when you see that Biden, it's more of a PR exercise and that he wants the deal, I think there's room to be optimistic. I think all the parties want a deal. I think we're heading towards it. I think the war in Yemen is going to wind down. The region is going to be divided between Iran and the U.S. And now it's about to what extent Saudi Arabia, Israel, and the UAE can ensure that they are also a party to what takes place in the region, or whether they will be steamrolled by this deal in a similar manner that Obama did in 2015.
All right,
the reality
stay with
is
me, Sami. Mustafa, 30 seconds.
I don't believe that there will be any kind of talks over the region or any other thing. I believe in Vienna we will see discussions over a return to the JCPOA. Tehran would not, you know, give up any of its requests. It would not cross the red line. It will, I believe, it will remain steadfast and very firm on its request for the removal of all sanctions and its verification by Iran before.
Okay. And on that note, I am so sorry. I appreciate both of you being with us on this debate. Journalist and political commentator Mustafa Khoshchesh out of Tehran and editor-in-chief of the International Interest, Sami Hamdi out of London. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Spiritual message of Islam.
His door is open, no matter who you are. Just take the first step, you'll see it's not so far. If we all open our eyes to see, He is all that we need right now. And we can all come together somewhere, somehow.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. La hawla wa la quwwata illa billahi al-Aliyyi al-Azim. الحمد لله رب العالمين وصلى الله على سيدنا ونبينا أبي القاسم المصطفى محمد وعلى آله الطيبين الطاهرين لا سيما بقية الله في الأرضين أجل الله تعالى فرجه الشريف وجعلنا من أعوانه وأنصاره وشيعته. We've been studying different features of the community of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and after studying the necessity of being balanced, being truthful, being united, we talked about the necessity of observing the rights of each mu'min. And we said there are lots of rights that mu'minin should observe, and these are indeed to keep the community together and form a very solid, united community, like one body, as Rasulullah said, that the example of mu'minin in their love, in their sympathy, in their affection is like one jasad. مَثَلُ الْمُؤْمَنِينَ فِي تَوَادِّهِمْ وَتَرَاحُمْهِمْ وَتَعَاطُفِهِمْ كَمَثَلِ جَسَدْ. It's like one body. Different cells and organs of the same body. I want now to move on to another characteristic of the community of Ahlul Bayt, and that is to do Amr al-Ma'ruf and Nahy al-Munkar. Mu'mineen need advice, need support. Sometimes brothers ask, sisters ask, you know, what should we say to people about Imam Hussein when we want to introduce Imam Hussein? Of course, you know, we can say Imam Hussein was thirsty, children were mistreated. These are very important. But the main thing is this point. Why Imam Hussein was ready to go to all these difficulties and troubles for himself and his family? Because he wanted to give a lesson to all of us, not only as Muslims or as Shia, as all human beings, that when you see haq is ignored, when you see justice is ridiculed, when you see crimes are being done with the good names, under, you know, good names, hypocrisy, dishonesty is there, that is the time to do something to reform. Otherwise, you will be also counted as one of those corrupt people. Imam Hussein alayhi salam also said, as you know, this famous hadith, he quoted from Rasulullah, "Man ra'a sultanan ja'iran," whoever sees that there is an unjust king, ruler, who disregards the covenant of Allah, who treats people with zulm, who doesn't observe Allah's regulations, "Walam yuqayyir alayhi," and doesn't protest, doesn't object, بقولن, either by word or fail, كان حقا على الله أن يدخله مدخله. Allah has the right to put him in the same place that he puts that person in hell. كان حقا على الله أن يدخله مدخله. So if we keep silent and we don't do anything to stop battle, to stop zulm, we are also responsible. So we have to be saying this to the people about Imam Hussein. And I am sure then every person who wants to reform his society, I don't know, his country, then would be very much looking for getting inspiration from Imam Hussein alayhi salam, giving reference, courage, support from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Because Imam Hussein alayhi salam, as I explained, did something which was for humanity, not only for Muslims.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad. محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم.
One of the things that inshallah maybe I get time to explain is that before Imam Hussein there was always a problem, and also after Imam Hussein most of the time there's a problem. People try to justify differences by saying that these are different interpretations. Why Imam Ali alayhi salam was not given the right of Khilafah? They say, you know, there was misunderstanding, there was no agreement. People had different views. Why Muawiyah stood against Imam Ali? So he did ijtihad. He did his own ijtihad. Imam Ali did his own ijtihad. You know, all the things, you know, they justify. They say this was different understanding, different interpretation of Islam. So they try to make everything very much, you know, maintained and contained within different ijtihad and, you know, personal opinions and these type of things. Also, when you say what happened to other people, they also say this is internal issue. What happened between Imam Ali and, for example, Muawiyah or, you know, others? They say, okay, this is a problem inside Islam. Like what happens today. Today, unfortunately, there are many important issues for humanity, but many people try to say this is Sunni-Shia conflict. It's a big, you know, big crime, big zulm. There is no issue of Sunni-Shia. This is issue of haq, batil, zulm, adala. Of course, maybe there is no 100% haq on this side and 100% batil on that side. But you have to understand the general picture. But people want to say, no, this is Sunni-Shia conflict. So many things that have happened in the history, also they say the same. If Imam Kazim alayhi salam was killed by Harun, they say this was personal, internal problem between Muslims. There is nothing interesting for rest of humanity. But in the case of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the situation became so obvious. And the contrast between Imam and his army, and Yazid and his army, was so sharp that it's no longer possible for anyone to say this was because of different interpretation of Islam or because this was an internal issue among Muslims. No. This is the contrast between haq and batil, between virtues and vices, between zulm and adl. And this is why you see even Hindus have sympathy with Imam Hussein. If it was, you know, something based on different understanding of Islam, Hindus say, you know, this is your own business, it's not my business. You see Hindus, Christians, Sikhs, Zoroastrians, all have sympathy with Imam Hussein. Why? Because it has become an issue for humanity. Now we need to have this insight to continue this process and show Imam Hussein's values to the people of the world in the way that they can understand and they can appreciate as an issue for humanity, not only for the Shia, as something that all humanity can learn and benefit from. So this is what we have to do.
I'm looking back throughout the years to breathe is hard and my eyes are choked with tears. Your face and hair are full of light. Now it will soon be time to go. I feel you feeling calm now. Did the angel let you know?
O Allah, please send your salutations to Muhammad and all Muhammad. O Allah, please forgive us. Please forgive all our sins and mistakes and shortcomings. Please enable us to serve you with full honesty and truthfulness and sincerity. Please include us among the best followers of Muhammad and Ali Muhammad. Please protect and safeguard our community and our families and our youths from everything that you don't like. O Allah, please hasten the reappearance of Imam Zaman Ajjalallahu Ta'ala Farajahu Sharif Please make our Imam Zaman happy with what we do and what we say. Please answer his du'as for his faraj. Please give shifa to all people who are ill. Please give shifa to people who are ill in their body and in their soul. Oh Allah, please send your rahmah, your forgiveness to all who have passed away, especially brothers and sisters who were attending these majalis in this community and other communities. Our parents, our foreparents, our teachers, our ulama, our maraji, those who have passed away. Please let them be with Muhammad and Ali Muhammad right now. And please give long life and blessed life to the parents and to the teachers and maraji who are alive. Oh Allah, please make the last moment of our life the best moment of our life. Wa akhiru da'wana an alhamdulillahi rabbil alameen.
My ummah, he will say, Rasulullah on that day, even though we've strayed from him and his way. My brothers, my sisters in Islam, let's struggle, work and pray. If we are to bring back the glory of his way. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again. Let's become.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
United States report on global human rights practices looked at human rights issues in Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza as part of its global analysis on almost 200 nations. In the first such report of the Biden administration, the U.S. reaffirmed the recognition of Israel's sovereignty over the Golan Heights and the recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. That is while Washington has refused to slam the Israeli regime for its illegal occupation of the Palestinian territories as well as other crimes. More than 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation of the Palestinian territories of the West Bank and East Jerusalem outlets. That is why the UN Security Council has repeatedly condemned Israel's settlement activities in the occupied territories in several resolutions. Also, according to human rights groups, acts of violence by Israeli settlers against Palestinians and their property are a daily occurrence throughout the occupied West Bank. Additionally, Israel holds more than 7,000 Palestinians in its jails. Most of the prisoners are being held with no indictment or trial under a controversial policy known as administrative detention.
Well, in the first place, the U.S. lacks the moral authority to talk about human rights in any country outside of its own boundaries. Inside the U.S., there is systemic racism against people of color and against people of indigenous origin. And this has been going on for 400 years inside the what is now the United States. Their record has been terrible. And to just a couple of days ago, the trial of the police man who killed George Floyd is taking place. So the U.S. has no moral authority whatsoever.
The Israeli regime's crimes seem to have no end, and the international community only condemns the regime's atrocities in words. This is while Israel is violating international law. The Golan Heights were part of Syria until 1967, when the Israeli regime captured most of the area during the Six-Day War. In 1973, Egypt and Syria launched the war against the Israeli regime in an effort to recapture the occupied territories. However, with Washington's help, Israel managed to retain control over the territory it occupied before. Then in 1981, Israel declared its unilaterally annexing East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights in order to extend its own boundaries to cover the captured territories. In response, the UN Security Council passed Resolution 497 and condemned the annexation of Syrian territory. The Council declared the annexation a violation of international law. Meanwhile, Syria has repeatedly reaffirmed its sovereignty over the Golan Heights, saying the territory must be completely restored to its control. The Golan Heights territory is strategically important due to its military value. It is also a strategic asset due to its water resources and fertile land. In a relatively parched region of the world, control over the Golan's water supplies is invaluable. The Golan Heights may also have oil. Exploratory drilling suggests that the territory's reservoirs could potentially yield billions of barrels of oil. The annual United States Report on Global Human Rights Practices also reaffirmed Israeli sovereignty over the Golan Heights, which the U.S. recognized in 2019. In March 2019, the former U.S. President Donald Trump signed a decree recognizing Israeli sovereignty over Golan during a meeting with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Washington. The Syrian government denounced Washington's recognition of Israeli claims over the Golan Heights as a blatant attack on the country's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Over the past decades, Israel has built dozens of settlements in the Golan Heights in defiance of international calls for the regime to stop its illegal construction activities.
Indeed, they are illegal. And nothing that the U.S. says or does can turn a crime into a legal act. Except for the USA, the entire world recognizes that the Golan Heights are part of the sovereign territory of Syria, and someday Syria will regain control of the Golan Heights.
The trial of former U.S. police officer Derek Chauvin began earlier this week. Chauvin is accused of killing 46-year-old African-American George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes during an arrest last May. Floyd's death triggered worldwide protests over brutal policing tactics and racial injustice. Prosecutors have said the former Minneapolis officer killed Floyd without regard for his life. They insist Chauvin betrayed his badge by kneeling on Floyd's neck and using excessive and unreasonable force as the black man kept begging for his life. The high-profile trial is expected to take 1 month. During the next few weeks, prosecutors will ask medical and use of force experts, among others, to testify. If convicted of murder and manslaughter charges, the former police officer could be jailed for decades. Chauvin has denied the charges. His defense lawyers argue that the force used during the arrest was reasonable and that Floyd died of an overdose and poor health. U.S. police officers who cause a death while they're on duty are rarely charged, and only about a third of those charged are convicted. This ongoing trial is followed across the U.S. and around the world as a strong indication of how the American legal system treats deaths in police custody. The ongoing trial has captured media attention in the U.S. and around the world. Everyone wants to know how the proceedings will end. But there is still a strong possibility that justice will not be served in Floyd's case, just as it wasn't served in many other high-profile police killings of unarmed African Americans over the past years. The 2014 police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson was another example in which the white officer who shot the black man was not indicted. Black Americans are disproportionately more likely to be fatally shot by police and arrested for drug abuse, and 5 times more likely than white Americans to be imprisoned. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon.
Black people in the United States are incarcerated, jailed, locked up, arrested more than any other race at more than any other rate in this country, disproportionate to their percentage of the population. Even though black people in the United States represent just over 13% of the population, they're targeted and they're victimized more to the prison industrial complex more than any other group in the United States. And that's something that we really have to begin to tackle in the United States to understand the roots of the prison industrial complex, of the police as catchers of enslaved people.
Observers largely attribute this trend to the racist roots of American policing and social structures. Law enforcement in many U.S. states, especially those in the south of the United States, have their roots in slave patrols that were formed centuries ago. Such patrols located and forcefully returned enslaved people who had escaped.
The first reason for police to begin with to exist in the United States were to catch enslaved people who liberated themselves from their owners who fled to the north. And that's why you'll see the first badges of the police from the 1800s said the words slave patrol, because that was one of their first jobs, to catch liberated enslaved peoples who were running to the north for freedom, for economic opportunity. That's the roots of policing in the United States, and we have to contend with that in order to deal with this.
The federal government banned the use of racist regulations at the state and local level many decades ago. Yet, ethnic minorities are subject to discrimination and profiling. Former U.S. President Donald Trump gained notoriety for fueling racial tensions and discrimination through provocative comments and stances. His successor, Joe Biden, has been an outspoken critic of racial injustice. But it remains to be seen whether he can truly lead the U.S. towards a less racially discriminative future.
Iran and China have signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed by the foreign ministers of the two countries in Tehran. The agreement includes political, strategic, and economic cooperation over the next 25 years. The pact would see Iran supply China with oil for 25 years. In return, China would invest in Iran's ports as well as its banking and telecom sectors. The pact has been in works since 2016, when President Xi Jinping became the first Chinese leader to visit the Iranian capital in over a decade. Many believe that the Iran-China agreement is aimed at standing up against U.S. pressure on the two countries.
Apart from this bilateral perspective, I think this signed agreement could be considered as a response, in a sense, in order to broaden the scope of the options that Iran has in its foreign policy. Knowing the fact that Iran has been practicing negotiations with the Western side, and then after all these years, and after JCPOA was signed and sealed, and later on was kind of not effective for Iranian signatory of the deal, now there is this consensus among Iranian politicians that they should broaden the scope of their international relations, and obviously China is going to be one of the most powerful options to be taken into consideration.
The agreement drew an outright reaction from Washington.
How concerning is the emerging partnership between China and Iran?
I've been concerned about that for a year.
Biden made the remarks in an address to reporters in the U.S. city of Wilmington. In response, Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said the signing of the Iran and China Strategic Partnership Roadmap is part of the active resistance policy. Shamkhani said the world isn't just the West, noting, however, that Biden's concern is justified as a flourishing of strategic cooperation in the East will accelerate the U.S. decline.
Well, I think the agreement that we are currently discussing could kind of pave the way for the U.S. hegemony to be broken, at least in Asia. And this is quite against the strategies that the United States is following in order to, let's say, increase its hegemonic power, specifically in Asia and particularly in the Middle East. So this particular framework could kind of, let's say, put the United States in a rather isolated situation, and could, of course, put China and Iran in a better situation.
Iran's closer cooperation with China, on one hand, can help Tehran shore up its economy against the impacts of the U.S. sanctions. On the other hand, the Tehran-Beijing alliance may be seen as a challenge to President Biden's China policy. This as the two major economic powers have been at odds over a string of issues, including trade, with each side having imposed tariffs worth of hundreds of billions of dollars on other side's goods. The stalemate has prompted China to increase its imports of Iranian oil to around 1 million barrels a day, eroding U.S. leverage. Many believe that China's new partnership with Iran is not a full alliance, but enough to undermine U.S. sanctions and rock the global status quo.
Whether we call it a strategic partnership or alliance or whatever you name it, the thing is that the very tangible consequence of this, let's say, new deal is that the world has to come to this realization that the calculations are, let's say, rapidly changing. And this in this recent situation, the United States and its Western partners are not going to be able to consider themselves as the only powers and as the only superpowers of the world with respect to the new emerging powers and with respect to great economic powers that are emerging in Asia. And this is going to definitely change the context, not only in the Middle East and not only in Asia, but also all over the world, and new line of calculations are going to be met for the years down the road.
This as Washington has expressed eagerness to enter stalled talks with Tehran to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled out Washington from the agreement, claiming Tehran violated it. This as the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has on multiple occasions reiterated Tehran's full compliance with the international accord. The Trump administration went even further by imposing a signature maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic. All in all, it seems that Iran and China can establish an economic bloc if Tehran-Beijing Comprehensive Partnership Agreement expands to other countries in Asia and through that confront the U.S. unilateralism.
On Sunday, people across the United States held marches and rallies to denounce the recent rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in the country. Protesters hit the streets in New York, San Francisco, Portland, and several other cities to show solidarity with the Asian American community. The demonstrations were held days after a gunman attacked three spas in the U.S. city of Atlanta, Georgia, killing eight people, six of whom were Asian women. The police are investigating whether the shooting spree was racially motivated, but the recent upsurge of verbal and physical attacks against the ethnic minority has raised serious concerns. The escalation of anti-Asian racism is attributed, for the most part, to the rhetoric adopted by former U.S. President Donald Trump after the novel coronavirus broke out in the country in March last year.
It's a disease, without question, has more names than any disease in history. I can name Kung Flu. I can name 19 different versions of names.
Why do you keep using this?
Because it comes from China.
Racist.
It's not racist at all, no, not at all. It comes from China.
But that's unlikely to be the only reason why the Asian community is increasingly coming under attack.
A lot of this anti-Asian violence and racism has been simmering underneath the surface of the United States for centuries now. Trump is only a product or a symptom of what's been white nationalist and white supremacist legislation, policies, and ideologies that have existed within the U.S. since its foundation.
Last year saw waves of anti-racism protests across the U.S. re-sparked following the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white Minneapolis police officer. With Trump no longer in the White House, many hoped things would turn for the better. But it seems like the former president has made a lasting impression that's proving hard to undo. The first instances of anti-Asian racism in the United States date back to the 1800s. The list includes the Chinese Massacre of 1871 in Los Angeles and the adoption of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, which led to a sharp decline in the Chinese population in the U.S. Following the bombing of Pearl Harbor in 1942, the U.S. government relocated over 120,000 Japanese Americans to 10 internment camps across the country, who lived under terrible conditions for up to 3 years.
The U.S. has a history of not only, you know, discriminating against Asians, but discriminating against anyone who was not white. Mexicans or Mexican Americans after the Mexican American War, or the history of enslavement, the history of genocide against Native Indigenous folks, and the history of barring Arabs and Muslims from coming into the country, or labeling them as terrorists or some other evil enemies of the United States. Every non-white group in the United States has really suffered institutionally and legally from the policies of the United States government.
Asian Americans are also encumbered by another set of biases in the context of their social life, that is, the stereotypes. They're generally regarded as hardworking, intelligent, and economically independent individuals. While the descriptions are mostly favorable, they hide other underlying issues, including racism, poverty, labor abuse, and psychological needs felt by the working class Asian Americans. The model minority myth also hurts other communities by creating a paragon for them to look up to. Several instances of violence against the African American community sparked outrage across the country over the past year. The protests are now being extended to confront the issue of systemic racism and racial injustice against members of other minority groups in the U.S. This begs the question, can the cause be a force to challenge the deep-seated prejudice against the minorities?
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, brothers and sisters, and thank you so very much for joining us on today's segment of The Lantern. Contrary to popular belief, especially after certain events that took place by the hands of some extremists during the few last decades, unfortunately, there's this common misconception that Islam is in some form a religion that promotes violence against those who don't see eye to eye with it, that Islam is an intolerant religion. So today I thought it would be a good idea if we talked about this whole concept of violence versus nonviolence, and how is it in any way, or whether it is it in any way, a resort, a solution for people who claim to be practicing the religion of Islam. Let's listen to a short little story regarding this matter, and we're going to be right back. Stay with us.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salamu alaikum and welcome to this program entitled Lantern, a story about Gandhi. Author Stephen R. Covey. I once heard Gandhi's grandson, Arun Gandhi, share this penetrating insight about his grandfather. All in attendance at his speech were both humbled and electrified. Ironically, if it hadn't been for a racism and prejudice, we may not have had a Gandhi. He may have been just another successful lawyer who had made a lot of money. But because of prejudice in South Africa, he was subjected to humiliation within a week of his arrival. He was thrown off a train because of the color of his skin, and it humiliated him so much that he sat on a platform of the station all night wondering what he could do to gain justice. His first response was one of the anger. He was so angry that he wanted eye for eye justice. He wanted to respond violently to the people who humiliated him. But he stopped himself and said, "That's not right." It was not going to get him justice. It might have made him feel good for a moment, but it wasn't going to get him any justice. The second response was to want to go back to India and live among his own people in dignity. He ruled that out also. He said, "You can't run away from problems. You've got to stay and face the problems." And that's when the third response dawned on him, the response of nonviolent action. From that point onwards, he developed the philosophy of nonviolence and practiced it in his life as well as in his search for justice in South Africa. He ended up staying in that country for 22 years, and then he went and led the movement of India.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
I'm sure you've all heard the story of Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam in the War of Khandaq, in the War of the Trench, and how one of the greatest warriors, Arab warriors, who was this huge man compared to Imam Ali alayhi salam, who was in the earlier years of his youth, is in a one-on-one battle with Imam Ali alayhi salam. And when Imam Ali alayhi salam struck him down and his back had hit the ground and he was about to get killed by Amir al-Mu'mineen, he spat in Imam Ali's face. And at that moment, Imam Ali had the chance to kill him right there and right then. What did he do? While everyone stood there in anticipation to see how would Ali strike his last blow onto his enemy and destroy him, Imam Ali alayhi salam put back his sword, went for a round, walked, breathed, came back, then killed his opponent. Why? Because even if he were to resort to violence, which was taking another human being's life, he would have to do it for the sheer, pure, sincere intention of Allah's satisfaction and the well-being of the Muslims. Imam Ali alayhi salam could not have any sort of personal, individual gains or grudge or feelings involved in it. There is a very interesting story regarding Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam. One day, His Eminence was sitting along with his companions. One day, His Eminence was sitting with a bunch of his companions, and a random dude comes up to the Imam and starts cursing the Imam out and cursing Amir al-Mu'mineen, and that, oh, you're the children of Ali, and Ali is this, and Ali is that, and you guys are this, and you guys are that. And obviously, the Imam's companions are enraged at this point, and they ask the Imam permission to destroy this guy. Who does he think he is talking to the grandson of Rasulullah and the Hujjah of Allah in such a manner? And Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, as the chill individual that he was, he said, because he is known as Kadhim al-Ghayb, the one who swallows his rage and does not express it. This is to an extent where his eminence is given the title that of the possessor of such an attribute, of such an attribution. Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says to them, "Nah, it's fine. Leave him. Let him be." Fast forward a few days, the Imam is riding on his horse in a field, and incidentally is that dude's field, and he's like, "Hey, what are you doing? You're stomping all over my crops. You're killing my plants. What's the deal, yo?" And the Imam gets off his horse, goes and sits beside the man who had cursed him out a few days ago, and then says, "Very nice crops you have this year. How much for all of it?" The dude says, 100 dirhams. The Imam says, "How much for the Prophet?" The dude says, "I don't know, yes, another 100. The Imam hands him over 300 dirhams and is like, "This is for you, your crops, and your profit that you would have made out of it." A few days later, he sees the Imam again in the same crowd. He comes up, he kisses the Imam's hands, and praises the Imam. And everyone was like, "What? what sorcery is this? What did the imam do? And the imam was like, I just expressed compassion. At that very moment, I could have drawn my sword. I could have chopped this guy's head off, and I would have, it would have been perhaps justifiable through a lot of people's eyes and mentality, because, well, he insulted me. And my grandfather, who is the imam, even if you don't believe in him as the imam, was the caliph, that's a big felony. But I didn't. I chose love. I chose compassion. I chose humanity. And I don't know, this could be really surprising for some people. It's surprising for me that it's still surprising for them. But never did the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam and Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam choose violence. It was always the final resort. It was always the final way out. Even during all the wars that Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam was present, and all the wars and battles that took place during his time, he was never him, neither him nor his army were the first to attack. They always taught us through their actions that let's start with negotiating. Let's start with talking about peace, about other solutions, other alternatives. That is the meaning of mercy for all of the world, for all of mankind. So anyone who says Islam allows us to kill other people just because they are not Muslim, just because they don't see eye to eye with us, just because they don't accept, heck, even if they insult us, is talking absolute nonsense and does not know anything about Islam and its core, its true teachings, and how peace and love is the very essence of this religion. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.